In 1990, the father of Libyan-American writer Hisham Matar was taken away by Gaddafi's agents. That kidnapping became the basis for Matar's acclaimed novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hisham Matar is visiting Iowa this week. We'll talk with him this hour about his novel and his father's disappearance. Also, his return to Libya last year after Gaddafi's demise. We'll also ask for his thoughts on the attack on the U.S. consulate and the recent anti-American protests by Muslims around the world. Libyan-American writer Hisham Matar, this hour after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Obama and Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney are looking for Hispanic votes as they take their campaigns to Florida today. The president is speaking at a Univision forum where he's expected to be questioned about his unfulfilled pledge to overhaul the nation's immigration system. Romney will speak in Sarasota. He's dealing with the fallout over recent remarks that were captured on video, in which he said his job is not to worry about the 47% of Americans who don't pay taxes. At a forum yesterday, Romney said his campaign is about the 100% in America. A Texas judge has stopped state officials from ordering purges of the voter rolls. The state was attempting to purge the rolls of dead voters. From Dallas, NPR's Wade Goodwin reports.
Using a death list from the Social Security Administration, the Texas Secretary of State sent out a list of 80,000 Texas voters who were to be considered dead. Social Security warned Texas the list shouldn't be relied upon for purging its rolls of voters, but the state ignored that caution. Tens of thousands of mostly elderly Texas voters got letters notifying them the state considered them dead. They had 30 days to respond or they would be removed from the voter rolls. Last night, Texas State Judge Tim Sulak responded to a lawsuit by four annoyed, not dead Texas voters by issuing a temporary injunction restraining the Secretary of State. Texas's attempt to implement a restrictive voter ID law was blocked by a federal court last month. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
Diplomats from more than 60 countries, including the U.S., are meeting in the Netherlands, calling themselves friends of the Syrian people. Terry Schultz reports they're discussing ways to drive President Bashar Assad from power.
In the fourth meeting of the Friends International Working Group, financial experts are advising governments how to close loopholes in sanctions against Assad and to identify companies or individuals trying to evade them. The European Union, the U.S., and the Arab League are among those sending envoys to the Hague meeting. 10 other countries have joined for the first time as international alarm over the continuing bloodshed grows. Participating countries have decided to set up contact points to advise the private sector how to comply with existing sanctions. Contracts for information and communication technology have been a particular concern. Dutch Foreign Minister Yuri Rosenthal is asking governments to closely monitor such exports, noting the regime is using these tools to oppress civilians and commit violence. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Libya is apologizing for an attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi that killed American Ambassador Christopher Stevens. The apology came as U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Williams Burns held talks in Tripoli with Libyan leaders. Three other Americans were also killed in last week's attacks. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 30 points. This is NPR News. Hundreds of Pakistanis outraged over a video that denigrates Islam's prophet are continuing to clash with police in the country's capital city. Police in Islamabad are estimating more than 1,000 people have gathered, mostly students. Videotape footage shows police using tear gas and batons to keep protesters away from buildings that house government offices and the U.S. Embassy. There are widespread protests across India today. As Elliot Hannon reports from New Delhi, demonstrators joined a nationwide strike to show opposition to the government's economic reforms.
A wave of protests forced schools and shops to close in many parts of the country. In some areas, protesters blocked roads and railways, leaving commuters stranded. The one-day strike was called by opposition political parties in response to a series of economic reforms intended to revive the lagging Indian economy. The most controversial measure is the decision to allow foreign supermarket chains like Walmart to open stores in the country, a move which opponents say will decimate small shop owners. The reforms, which were announced last week, have created a political firestorm and have raised questions about the stability of the country's coalition government. For NPR News, I'm Elliot Hannon in New Delhi.
South African police have killed two more people as authorities crack down on striking mine workers. Police killed 34 platinum miners last month. In the latest incidents, a municipal councillor was killed by rubber bullets, and a miner was reportedly run over by an armored police vehicle. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says his efforts to discuss aggressive Chinese cyber attacks against American companies and the government aren't getting very far. He says all he's been getting is agreements to talk again. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Staples Copy and Print, with print products and services for businesses like brochures and presentations at Staples stores or staples.com/copyandprint.
Time is 12:06. A quiet weather afternoon ahead here in Iowa. No precipitation. The sky is, for the most part, partly sunny in most locations. A few drifting clouds here and there. And our highs today from 65 to 75. Good chance of some showers tonight in north-central Iowa. Lesser chance of showers elsewhere in the state, and then partly sunny tomorrow with a chance of showers in the morning in central and eastern Iowa. 65 degrees in Des Moines, 66 in Cedar Rapids.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya last week has been in our news in recent days. Also, the debate around it reported in our news about what unfolded that night in Benghazi. Was that attack spontaneous or premeditated somehow? It's against this backdrop in our current affairs that we welcome this hour Libyan-American writer Hisham Mattar. In 1990, Hisham Mattar's father was taken away by Muammar Gaddafi's agents, and that kidnapping became the basis for Mattar's latest novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, published in 2011. The novel was named one of the best books of the year by many publications, among others the Chicago Tribune, The Guardian, The Daily Beast, The Irish Times. His first novel, In the Country of Men, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, the Guardian First Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Mattar also wrote about his return to Libya last year, or about the experience he had during the demise of Muammar Gaddafi's regime in the New York Times. Most recently, he's written an article for The New Yorker just days ago titled, What Was Really Behind the Benghazi Attack? And this week, Hisham Mattar is visiting Iowa as an Ida and Cordelia Beam Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Iowa. He joins me this afternoon in the studio. Hisham Mattar, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You were born in New York City to Libyan parents, as I understand, and spent your childhood first in Tripoli, in Libya, and then in Cairo. Your father was a Libyan dissident, and it was in Egypt, I understand, that he was kidnapped by Gaddafi's agents. That is the basis of your novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. And I wonder if we could begin this conversation by having you read the opening to that work.
Sure. There are times when my father's absence is as heavy as a child sitting on my chest. Other times I can barely recall the exact features of his face and must bring out the photographs I keep in an old envelope in the drawer of my bedside table. There has not been a day since his sudden and mysterious vanishing that I have not been searching for him, looking in the most unlikely places. Everything and everyone, existence itself, has become an evocation, a possibility for resemblance. Perhaps this is what is meant by that brief and now almost archaic word, elegy. I do not see him in the mirror, but feel him adjusting, as if he were twisting within a shirt that nearly fits. My father has always been intimately mysterious, even when he was present. I can almost imagine how it might have been coming to him as an equal, as a friend, but not quite. My father disappeared in 1972, at the beginning of my school Christmas holiday when I was 14. Muna and I were staying at the Montreux Palace, taking breakfast, I with my large glass of bright orange juice, and she with her steaming black tea, on the terrace overlooking the steel-blue surface of Lake Geneva, at the other end of which, beyond the hills and the bending waters, lay the now vacant city of Geneva. I was watching the silent paragliders hover above the still lake, and she was paging through La Tribune de Genève when suddenly her hand rose to her mouth and trembled. A few minutes later, we were aboard a train, hardly speaking, passing the newspaper back and forth. We collected from the police station the few belongings that were left on the bedside table. When I unsealed the small plastic bag, along with the tobacco and the lighter flint, I smelled him. That same watch is now wrapped round my wrist, and even today, after all these years, when I press the underside of the leather strap against my nostrils, I can detect a whiff of him.
My guest, Hisham Attar, novelist, reading from his latest novel, award-winning novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, published in 2011. That is a fictional account that you have created. The voice there we hear is the narrator of your novel, Nuri. He is a boy who experiences the disappearance of his father, as you did in real life. Tell us, what did you want to accomplish with this novel by fictionalizing a disappearance of a boy's father that you could not do with a real-life account of telling your own story of having your father disappear in 1990?
Mm. Well, you know, the distance between a novelist's use of the pronoun I and the novelist is a very interesting distance, and one that is in some ways incredibly difficult to illustrate. But in this case, what I was doing is I was taking an experience that I knew, concerns that I had, my obsessions, in other words, and using them to create a fictional world that involves characters that are very different from me and my father, and that those differences allow me to meditate over, to think about, to explore different psychological states, and in order to meditate over my obsession in a way that isn't narcissistic or in a way that isn't limited to my own experience, but in a way that goes into the world.
How did you make Nuri, the fictional character, the fictional boy, how did you make him different than the real-life boy, Hisham, you?
I didn't need to make him different. I mean, I discovered him on the page. I wasn't deliberately trying to, I mean, like what you said, fictionalizing. You know, I wasn't fictionalizing. I didn't at all feel that I was somehow taking something, an event that had happened to me, and obscuring it with other details. It wasn't like that at all. What I had taken is I had taken my grief, and I had taken my knowledge of this very peculiar sense of loss. When you lose somebody not to death, which is what sadly we all eventually become familiar with, when you lose somebody to a disappearance, the idea, the possibility that they are existing at the same moment as you are, that in the same hour, in the same minute, the same second, under the same moon, under the same sun, they are here, but they're not here. They are the absent present. No. That alters and influences the quality of the grief and the weight of the longing. You know, it changes it very, it's very different. I've had people, dear people to me, thankfully not many, who passed away. So I am able to see the differences here. And so I thought, well, that's a very curious, I mean, in some sense, it's a tragedy. Of course it is. But in another sense, it's sort of, I've been allowed access to a kind of knowledge of the world, of our relationship to loss. And how could I take that knowledge and create a work of art out of it? That was the intention. It wasn't trying to fictionalize. It wasn't trying to tell my own story.
You said that you chose this form, the novel, to deal with your own experience, to use the word distance. Was it also
that form that was chosen and that distance put there so that you could address it? Is it too painful to address if you would write a nonfiction account about it?
The experience of writing nonfiction is very different. You know, the creative experience is very different. I mean, this book was very difficult for me to write. Difficult technically, it was very challenging. Its relationship to time and these very complex themes that I was trying to formulate in some way. But it was also very difficult emotionally. You know, putting myself in that psychological space where I'm trying to think about this very difficult subject for 3 years or 3.5 years was not a choice. If I had a choice, I would have written something completely different.
You were compelled to do this.
Yes. I mean, I think like most writers, you don't choose the books you write. You write the books that you must write, that you feel compelled to write. And they enter your imagination and you can't get rid of them. And then you think, well, I have two choices here. I can either be authentic to my imagination and write this, or I could put it off and hope that it would go away and something else will come. No? But I found it, you know, you could say maybe it's a little bit perverse because it's painful and difficult, but on some other level, creatively and intellectually and emotionally and in every way, and technically, writing this book was great fun too. It was real challenge, and it was exhilarating when I finished it because it almost destroyed me. You know, it came to a point when I thought it's me or the book. And a lot of novelists, friends of mine, people that I've read, come to that point. You know, I think Mario Vargas Llosa said that you either, you know, it's one of you has to destroy the other. You either destroy the book or the book destroys you. And I felt at some moment, I felt that there's a very high chance that this book is going to finish me. And I devised a very complex scheme of destroying the book, because in modern times you can't just simply burn the book because it exists in so many electronical forms, no? So I tried to sort of devise such a system that I press one button and it will just vanish from all of the backups, no?
You were actually contemplating yes. getting rid of it completely.
Well, because it was, you know, 2 years into the book, I hit a very difficult spot with it. And I felt
What was that spot?
It was, I mean, in a sense that, you know, 2 years into the book, I ran out of stamina. The book wasn't done and it needed more energy from me and more commitment. And I was exhausted emotionally. And I felt that I just can't think about this anymore. It's very, and actually in the, you know, the curious thing is that once you finish it and you read it, it's sort of distant from you. You know, I can read it. But then there are passages that you didn't think were painful to write at all, that surprising passages that I can never read in this book. Because if I read them, they'll destroy me. You know, they'll move me very deeply. So,
if you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Libyan American writer Hisham Matar. In 1990, Matar's father was taken away by Muammar Gaddafi's agents, and that real-life kidnapping became the basis for Matar's latest novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, and he's a visiting professor at the University of Iowa this week. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, your questions for Hisham Matar this hour about writing, about our understanding of the forces at work in Libya and the Muslim world, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. The whereabouts, you talking about the real-life story of your father now. Your father was a dissident. What can you tell us about him and your family about the real-life disappearance that you experienced?
Well, my family moved to Egypt in the late 70s. And 11 years later, in 1990, my father, who had been an outspoken critic and dissident of the Gaddafi regime, was kidnapped from his home by Egyptian agents who were then very close to the Libyan agents, and handed my father over to the Libyans. And my father was flown to Libya and imprisoned. But none of this was acknowledged. We simply didn't know where he was. The Egyptians lied to us, told us that he was being kept in Egypt, and sort of threatened us, said, you know, if you make too much noise about this, we can't guarantee his safety, mm-hmm. Speaking in oblique terms like that. So we believed that he was in Egypt for 2.5 years, 3 years.
Were you actually with him or near him when he was kidnapped?
No, I wasn't. I was studying in London, and this happened in Cairo. I flew to Cairo the following day, but you know, I was on the phone to him, very very close to it. So 2-3 years into this terrible event, we received a letter that was smuggled out of Abu Slim prison, which is a very notorious, infamous political prison in Tripoli. And it was in my father's hand, and it detailed exactly what had happened, which was that he was flown to Libya the next day from when he was kidnapped. And then these letters, we got a couple of other letters smuggled, a very, very difficult way for them to reach us. And then, which, you know, placed a lot of very brave people in danger. People risked their lives to get those letters to us. In 1996, all the news about him stopped. People that had left the prison that used to say we've seen him there or something, no one had seen him after 1996. So we remain in the dark. I mean, it's obvious now that all the political prisons have been opened, everybody accounted for, and my father is not amongst them. So it's obvious that he was killed in prison. This is unfortunately not a totally unusual story, because there's, you know, we have a lot of people that have disappeared and we don't know where they are. We don't know what had happened to them, where they might be buried, you know, all these questions. But I have to, you know, always when I talk about the subject, Ben, I always think, you know, I'm an incredibly private person, and the reason I had to talk about this a lot is obvious, because I was campaigning for his whereabouts. I've been involved in various human rights campaigns about human rights in Libya, and particularly about my father. But every time I do talk about it out of necessity, I always feel this, you know, genuine, warm sense of sympathy from others, and sympathy that verges sometimes a bit on pity sometimes, and I always feel that it's necessary to say this, not out of a false sense of pride at all, but just out of the desire to be accurate and also to make it more clear that in some level this is a terrible tragedy. It's been an incredible weight on my life. I'm 41, so this is my father's been gone for 22 years, more than half of my life has been spent under this dark cloud. But in another level, it has been incredibly convenient being my father's son. You know, he was this really great man. You know, he was gentle. He was generous. He was funny. He was interesting. He was interested in the world and interested in literature and interested in difference. Instilled in us the ability to be curious about the other opinion, about the other, full stop. No, and also it's a huge privilege, because you don't choose your father. It's a pure accident. No, and it's in an environment of where people were put under huge strain, and good people had to sell out and do terrible things. It is really huge good fortune and good luck that I don't have to live with the legacy that my father did some terrible thing. You know, so that's what I mean by it being convenient.
Libyan-American writer Hisham Matar, my guest this hour. Last year, the world experienced, and with joy, the ousting of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, his regime falling. You were where at that time? You wrote about it.
I was in London.
You were in London.
I was in London, and in the early days, you know, they fenced off the country. You know, the Gaddafi regime was getting very anxious, and they built this wall of silence around the country. No journalists can go in, and the journalists inside can't communicate with the outside. So I was in London, and I set up in my home with a bunch of friends a sort of newsroom. And I became a hack. I became a journalist. Sorry, I have high admiration for journalists, but we were collecting accounts from doctors and nurses and lawyers and people on the ground and typing them up and feeding them to the world media.
And as I see, I'm holding up a reprint of a New York Times article from March of 2011, in which it is an account of the contact you had with your relatives and friends in Libya, but also a plea to help the rebels.
Yes, it was an incredibly dangerous moment. You know, I mean, if you were to visit Benghazi and speak to the people there about the moment that the army was entering the city, you know, only that would tell you what was about to happen.
Right, and the tactics that were used. You recount in the article how the civilians were used by the government troops.
Yeah. I mean, there's decency in war is infinitely indecent, but even in war, there are ways of doing things properly. There were no limits. There was nothing that they weren't prepared to do. They would go, for example, to primary schools and speak to 8 and 7 and 9 year old kids. Saying to them, so tell us, what are your parents speaking about at home? What television channel are they watching? You know, things like that. And then acting upon that information, you know. From that to, you know, just, you know, executions and...
Or as you recount in your article, using children in a town square when the rebels were advancing, civilians would be brought out if the rebels would advance, the children would be shot.
Yeah. I mean, I think to understand what was happening to Libya, you have to know that it wasn't a state. You know, the government wasn't functioning as a state. They were functioning under the logic of a family. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit like gangsters in a sense. Yeah.
We have a minute or so before the break. What was your experience when it was the end? We saw that horrible video of Gaddafi's end.
Hard to say that in a minute, but in very briefly, I was horrified by it. I was upset that I felt it was an opportunity, you know, to do something better. But over and above my own personal feelings, it was also a moment that in it was played out the kind of revulsion and psychological strain that the country was under because of this guy.
Did you think it had to happen that way, that his end had to come in such a brutal way rather than before a trial in a court?
I mean, I wouldn't have chosen it that way, but I can understand why it happened that way. I can understand understanding and, approving are not the same thing, but I can understand it.
We're going to take a short break and be back with more of a conversation with Libyan-American writer Hisham Matar. In 1990, Matar's father was taken away by Muammar Gaddafi's agents, a kidnapping that became the basis for his latest novel, award-winning novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll ask Hisham Matar about this latest attack in Libya, the attack on the U.S. consulate last week, cost the life of the U.S. ambassador and three other Americans. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support comes from AEG Live, hosting an evening with David Sedaris at the IMU Main Lounge in Iowa City on Wednesday, November 7th at 8 p.m. Ticket information online at aeglive.com and Ticketmaster.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we are in New Orleans, the city that keeps blossoming no matter what Mother Nature throws at her. It's a food town like no other. So join us. That's this week on The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Saturday at 2 p.m. and Sunday at 11 a.m. on Iowa Public Radio. Support comes from the University of Iowa Museum of Art, inviting you to Le Musée Party, the museum's 10th annual gala, on October 13th at Hotel Vetro. More at uima.uiowa.edu.
It's 12:30. I'm Dennis Reese, Iowa Public Radio News. Republican leaders in the U.S. House have scheduled a vote this week on a bill to help the coal industry, but refuse to schedule votes on the farm bill or on legislation to extend a key tax credit for the wind industry. Congressman Leonard Boswell, a Democrat from Des Moines, made a pitch for the farm bill last night before the U.S. House Committee on Rules, the panel that sets the debate agenda for the House.
We've heard discussion on and on and on about the importance of the farm bill. So I thought, well, maybe there's a chance before this committee.
Neil.
If you take this opportunity to respond to what we're hearing across the country from everybody, seems to me, to put the Senate bill out in front of us and let's discuss it, debate it, amend it, do whatever, and get the thing to conference and let's see what we can do.
The eight Republicans on the committee shot down Boswell's request for a vote in the House on the Senate-passed farm bill. Boswell also had asked the committee to schedule a vote on the wind production tax credit, as it is set to expire on December 31st. Well, this week's announcement by a wind blade maker that it's cutting more than 400 jobs in southeast Iowa is a heartbreaking loss. According to Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, Siemens is eliminating two-thirds of its workforce in Fort Madison. And Harkin, a Democrat, is pointing his finger at Republicans for causing the deep job cuts.
What makes this all the harder to take is that it's unnecessary. Siemens blames the layoffs in large measure on market conditions created by Congress's failure to extend the wind energy tax credit. This underscores it yet again, the huge cost in terms of jobs and economic growth of the decision by congressional Republicans to block essential jobs legislation.
Senator Harkin, about 220 jobs will remain at the company's Iowa plant, one of the largest employers in Lee County. The combination of high floodwaters followed by drought that is shrinking most rivers has yielded an historic find. Two boys fishing in the Cedar River near downtown Cedar Rapids snagged a bison skull. The University of Iowa retired geoscience professor Holmes Semkin estimates is about 5,000 years old, but in very good condition.
More often than not, when bison skulls or any other bones get in the river, they get rounded, broken, crushed. This one was a fairly complete cranium with the nasals preserved, and those usually are the first bones to go away.
Semkin speculates recent floodwater swept the skull into the Cedar River. UI Museum of Natural History Education Director Sarah Horgan says she advised the boys on preserving the bison skull, but hopes it'll be in the museum someday.
They did ask about possibilities for who might be interested in the skull, and we did say that the museum would be interested. It's a fantastic specimen and could be used for educational programs and possible displays down the road, and because it is so rare from eastern Iowa.
Oregon says bison bones in eastern Iowa are fairly rare because bison herds were more common in the western parts of the state. Some Iowans will soon have two driver's license options. Iowa's Department of Transportation will be issuing what is called Real ID cards, doubling as a driver's license and an identification card for expediting security checks at airports and federal installations such as U.S. courthouses. The new system comes from Congress passing what is called the Real ID Act 7 years ago. It's a recommendation of the commission that studied the 9/11 attacks. Iowa DOT officials say the new cards will be required for those who haven't previously held an Iowa driver's license. Those already holding Iowa licenses have the option of applying for the new Real ID cards or continuing the use to use the license they're now using. The new system goes into effect January 15th. Many states are choosing not to issue the cards, but Iowa's DOT made the decision last week to implement the system. Officials say someone who bought a Powerball ticket at a Des Moines store has won $1 million in the Iowa lottery. The lottery said in a news release today that the ticket matched 5 of the 6 Powerball numbers drawn last night. The ticket was sold at a Dahl's grocery store on Fluor Drive in Des Moines. The winner has yet to step forward. Some clouds passing through from time to time, otherwise a partly sunny afternoon ahead, highs 65 to 75. A chance of showers tonight mostly in north-central Iowa, lows mid-40s to low 50s. That's Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dennis Reese, 1235.
Support comes from the Lux Zone and Jan Finlayson Designs. Locally owned, offering fine furnishings, gifts, and customized interior design at Coralville's Plaza on 5th. More at theluxzone.com. Memorable places start here.
This is Pat Blank. On this afternoon's All Things Considered, rural electric cooperatives operating in Iowa and 8 other states are getting federal loan guarantees to improve portions of their power lines and generating systems. And the combination of high flood water followed by drought has yielded an historic find. 2 boys fishing in downtown Cedar Rapids have snagged a bison skull. Those stories in a forecast that includes possible record low temperatures. All the details beginning at 4 here on Iowa Public Radio.
Support comes from the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City, presenting Loudon Wainwright and Dar Williams on Friday, September 21st at 8 p.m. Details and tickets can be found at englert.org.
Wonderful to have your company on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest this entire hour is Libyan-American writer Hisham Matar. He is currently a visiting professor at the University of Iowa, as an Ida and Cordelia Beam Distinguished Visiting Professor during this week. And in 1990, Hisham Matar's father was taken away by Muammar Gaddafi's agents, and it's that kidnapping that became the basis for Matar's award-winning and latest novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, named one of the best books of the year by many publications. Hisham Matar, I wanted to talk to you about the Libya that's been in our news in recent days. Unfortunately, the attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya last week, it's led to a debate in this country, as you know, reported in our news about what unfolded that night in Benghazi. Was the attack spontaneous or premeditated? The Obama administration says the attack that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and 3 other Americans was spontaneous. That it was staged by local extremists who saw an attack as an opportunity to hijack some peaceful demonstrations against an offensive film from California. And Libyans have a different view. They say it was a premeditated strike launched by foreign fighters with ties to al-Qaeda. Immediately after the attack, you wrote an article for The New Yorker titled, What Was Really Behind the Benghazi Attack? How did you answer that question?
Well, there are certain things that raise our curiosity about that attack. One of them is that whenever people are upset, so whenever there is a popular outcry about anything, something like this film, there are some hallmarks to it. And those hallmarks are that people talk about it, conversations on the streets. Many Libyans are on Twitter and Facebook. Particularly throughout the revolution, Facebook became a very important medium. A lot of the kind of shared concerns are aired there. People write articles, talk about it. None of these things happen. I don't know one Libyan who even heard of the film, let alone seen it.
On the night, the people attacking that consulate had never heard of the film, you're saying?
Well, I don't know the people who had attacked the consulate, but I'm just telling you that most people I know and all of the people that they know don't know anything about the film, and certainly it wasn't a demonstration in front of the embassy. Look, one of my cousins is a judge in Benghazi, and I called him before I wrote the article. He was one of the 20 or so people that I called, and I said, "What do you know?" And he said, "Well, you know, my regular cafe where I go and have my hubbly bubbly is opposite the consulate." And I was there when it happened. I saw it all. He said there was no demonstration, there were no placards. It wasn't what you think. You know, people gather and some hothead, you know, throws a stone and things escalate, somebody fires a gun. It was nothing like that at all. There was no one, literally no one in front of the American consulate. And then suddenly these armed to the teeth trucks turn up. And there was no preamble. There was no, you know, apologize now or else. It was just an immediate ferocious attack, very quick, and they escaped very quickly. So that, to me, has the hallmark of similar attacks that have happened in Benghazi on other consulates, on the hospital, on the courthouse, right? And what is happening in Libya is that you have a moment, a very fragile, incredibly precarious moment, which is where we are in now, where there are institutions being built and things are progressing well, very well, given the poor start we've had. But there's also a moment that authoritarian, extreme right groups, whether under a religious banner or other, but they resemble to me the Milan fascio, you know, the thugs that Mussolini used to take power, that weren't basically trying to convince you of anything, that were just scaring you into a certain situation. Who are trying to capitalize on this moment of vulnerability?
This ties into, or how does this tie into the protests worldwide in many places in the world among Muslims, anti-American protests, including in Libya? Help us understand why Muslims in Libya should be anti-American in protest.
Well, the most effective thing that attack did, I mean, obviously over and above the loss of innocent lives, the most devastating thing it did, second to that, is that it made a film that nobody knew about, nobody cared about, made it very well known. Lots of people saw it, and that provoked a lot of upset. Now, look, the question about you know, why do people feel this way about Americans? So it's a very complicated question. It's hard to abbreviate it, but you have to really put it into context. The experience of America in many places of the world, unfortunately, is a violent experience. And this is something that a lot of Americans resist naturally, and a lot of Americans don't understand, because America from the inside is this wonderful place, a place of reason and a place of democracy and a place where people have opportunity and people are treated equally to a certain extent. But in a lot of other countries like in the Middle East, the experience of America, not recently, for a very long time, is an intrusive, manipulative, violent involvement that favors authoritarian regimes over democratic movements. That's been the case for a while. Now, the tone is changing very, very much under this current administration. Mm-hmm. But these things take a while. The thing to point out, though, particularly in Libya, is that the feelings towards America are not to be judged by this act. You should judge them by what happened immediately after this attack. The spontaneous demonstrations that went out into the streets.
Which, to my knowledge, were not well covered by the media here.
They weren't well covered, and they were truly spontaneous. I mean, nobody... You know, I know several people who went to these demonstrations. There's nobody, you know, they weren't being cajoled by the government into this to save face or anything like that. I mean, they were really genuine.
What were they demonstrating? The sadness over the loss of life, especially the
Absolutely.
Ambassador Stevens?
I mean, Ambassador Stevens was a very popular figure in Libya long before, you know, this happened. And it's not usual for any diplomat from any country to be popular. You know, I mean, that's not the sort of... But he was, an incredibly popular figure, and people demonstrated that. But more significantly, they wanted the world to know that these people don't represent us. And also, the big concern is that attacks like this succeed into isolating exactly the people who need international support. You know, international cultural events will be interrupted. People who had planned visits there for NGOs have canceled them. You know, things like that are a huge concern. But primarily, the message I think that those demonstrations were articulating is that these people don't represent us.
I wanted to save a little bit of time to talk about writing, your process of writing, but perhaps we could wind up the talk on Libya here by I wanted to, from your article about the latest attack in Libya, you write, following a demanding revolution and the exuberances of victory, Libya has entered a phase of fatigue and cynicism.
Yeah. Yes, revolutions are not the ideal way for political change. They are the last resort. I have never romanticized revolutions. I am by temperament suspicious and wary of them. They demand too much sacrifice. And usually after a revolution, there are you know, there is this phase that every country has to pass through. They take a lot of energy, you know, a lot of energy, and people are tired. People are tired. But I see it as a natural process. I don't see it as an unusual thing.
Libyan American writer Hisham Matar, my guest for this hour, winding up the hour. I'd like to his latest novel, award-winning novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance, a novel that took the basis of his real life, the disappearance of his father, taken away by Muammar Gaddafi's agents in 1990. I wonder, last night you gave a presentation I was at, and you had one quote that made me laugh out loud. I'd like you to explain it. You said, thinking is very bad for writing.
Yes, yes, and it surprised me, you know, when I was starting out as a writer and learning. I'm still learning, but you know, it continues to surprise me that deliberate. What I mean by thinking is deliberate seeking. You know, deliberate attempts to seek the thing, to try to structure it, to impose on it logic and sense. You know. Is a very good way to destroy a work. In other words, the writer, for me, is somebody who makes himself or herself available to the world.
A conduit.
Yeah, available to whatever it is they are interested in, you know? Nature or details around their lives, works of art that they respond to. That's all you really need to do as a writer. You don't force it. You know, that's all you need to do. And once you have a book in you, the book will let you know that it's here. And you go about serving it, and you listen to it. And you trust the fact that all of that is happening anyway inside of you. And all of the deliberate thinking and, you know, I want my book to be in this place, or I want to be this sort of successful writer, or I want this sort of advance, or I should write at least a book every 2 years or else I'm not a productive. All of these things belong to a different intellect, to the intellect that is cooking up these books.
Right. You make it sound a bit nicer than you did earlier in the hour when you said that this novel almost destroyed you and you had to destroy it figuratively.
Yes. I mean, that's part of the challenge. And that's what I meant by fearing that it would sound perverse. But that's also part of the enjoyment. You know, that in a sense, it's like climbing a mountain. You know, you climb the mountain because it's there. Mm. And you climb the mountain knowing that it might defeat you. And actually, once you... I've spoken to climbers about this. It's very interesting, the parallels, because once you do reach the summit, you have this incredible sense of exhilaration, like when you finish a novel. You're exhilarated. You're like what Hemingway said. He said, you know, I feel like a beautiful woman who has just had a child and people should come with flowers. Where are they? You know, you feel this sense of joy. But once you come down from that, usually in my case takes about 3 days, come down from that, once you come down from the mountain, it's this deep sense of emptiness and you don't know what to do with your days because your days for the last 3.5 years have been governed and managed by this thing. You are a custodian of the work, you know, you are under custody. So there's a sense of bewilderment and emptiness.
So can you describe for me the state that you are in when you are at your best writing? What is it like?
Effortless. What it's like is, what, and those are very, very, very rare moments. They're like, you know, hitting the sweet spot of a racket. You know, you feel that you really don't need to do much at all. You know, I used to be a stonemason at some point.
Really?
And when I first started, you know, when I first day I turned up to learn how to be a stonemason, I thought, stone, chisel, mallet, man. You know, just keep beating the hell out of this thing. And I and the instructor came over to me and he said, no, this is incredibly gentle work. All you have to do is place the chisel at the moment where the stone is weak. And all you do is let the mallet fall with its weight on. You don't need any muscles at all to do that. It's very simple. And it's a bit like that with when it's going very well. It feels like I am in the right space. And it feels as if the text is ahead of me, that there are the really, really, really miraculous moments for me are they only last for about 2 or 3 minutes, is when you've written a paragraph that you thought you'd never write. That paragraph exceeds your abilities. That paragraph is better than you. It's more intelligent, it's more elegant, it's more interesting than you are.
Does it happen that it comes off that way in such perfection in the first draft?
Very, very rarely. But in my case, not longer than a short paragraph. And then, you know, you go through the revisions, the endless rewrites.
Okay. So that's your writing state, your state of writing at its best.
Yeah,
at its worst. Let's go there.
But at its worst, I feel I've been cast out. I feel, you know, that feeling when you're young and you are, you know, you've met a couple of people you like that, you know, finally you found people that like the same music and the same, when you thought you were a freak and now you don't anymore. And then you know they are in town and they've met somewhere at some cafe, but you don't know where that cafe is and you can't reach them. And that horrible feeling that you're completely alone when you don't need to be alone, no?
Or right.
That somehow you're not aligned with the stars. You're out of whack.
So how as a writer do you find those friends, reconnect?
I try not to stop. So I keep writing. I rewrite what I wrote the day before. I try to just, be as the moments that it works, the moments that I find my way back are the moments when I'm being very gentle with myself and with the work. Very, very gentle. Mm. The moments where it doesn't work is where the ego comes in. It becomes about doubt. I'm not a writer anymore. This is terrible. It's not about the work. All these questions are about me, you know. And those are the moments when it doesn't work at all. So I find it actually incredibly humbling writing because you're forever trying to get yourself out of the way.
Hisham Attar, when did you first know you were a writer or have some sense that this is what you wanted to be?
It happened in stages, but I think the first moment I thought, I can do this. This is what I want to do. This is what, maybe the first one that I remember, is when I was 19 years old and I read Catcher in the Rye. I read that book and I thought, I can do this. You know, it makes me blush saying it because it's a great book.
A lot of people have that thought, but then they can't do that. They can't do that.
I think I can do that. And I think I'd really have a great time doing it. I had the good fortune of being interested in three different things. I was interested in poetry, in music. I wanted to be a musician at some point, and I was interested in architecture. And I became an architect. And I always thought those three things need to be united somehow. That's really what I want to do. And why I feel incredibly privileged is that the novel has those three things or the things that I was interested in those three things, which are, to be very, very brief, what I am interested in is, I think, what all novels ask this question, how to live.
Mm. Well, people listening to this conversation this hour are probably wondering why I haven't asked you about your return to Libya. You have returned to Libya, but that is to be portrayed in an upcoming article in The New Yorker. And I don't know how much you can say about it at this point. Probably not much.
Well, I'm writing it, so it's always tricky talking about something you're working on. But I returned after 33 years of not being able to go back.
Okay.
And it was a huge rite of passage for me. There's a word that used to always make me cringe a bit when I hear it, and it's a popular word people use. It say this was a transforming experience. What are you talking about? What does that mean? I don't understand that word. And now I do. Now when people say transforming, I know exactly what they mean.
We'll look forward to reading about that. How familiar, you've had a very short week as a visiting professor Iowa. How familiar were you with Iowa before coming here?
This is my first visit. I have fallen in love with your city. It's wonderful. I mean, you know, maybe paradise is not rivers of honey and wine. Maybe paradise is a city like this with all these writers, wonderful bookshops. People are interested in writing. People are very kind and patient and generous. Maybe I've just met your best lot. Maybe the other ones are hiding somewhere, but I really feel really grateful to be hosted here.
And before you came here, those four letters, Iowa, that spell Iowa, meant what to you?
Very little. I didn't know much about Iowa. All I knew is the usual, you know, obnoxious reservations or stereotypes that people in New York say about anywhere else outside of New York.
Oh, do tell. What's that?
I've learned to distrust that. But look, I've been. This is the end of a very long tour. In the last year, I've flown 150 hours, and I'm not a good. I don't like airplanes. So I am. I wasn't super excited about having to do more events and so on, but I'm so glad I came here. It's been really, really lovely. And if it's possible to thank the city in an abstract sense, then you know, thank you, Iowa City.
Have you encountered much Libyan or Arab culture in Iowa?
Well, I've met some of the Arabic writers that are at the IWP, the International Writers Program. Who are here for 10 weeks. Those are the only Arabs that I've met here.
Any other surprises that you've come across here in closing?
Well, just the incredible concentration of writers in the city.
Iowa City.
In Iowa City. And also great readers, you know, very, very, very international, people who read internationally. It's the definition of provincialism, I think, is where you think that where you live is the center of the world. And the wonderful thing about Iowa City is you get the sense, because of the books people are reading, is that they don't feel that way at all. They feel that they are, the world is the world, and we want to know about the world. And that's a lovely quality. But I think maybe you're hiding the other lot from me.
You'll have to come back and find out.
Come back.
Hisham Matar, it's been so wonderful to have you come into our studio, visit our state, and be with us. We hope you will return. Hisham Matar,
I hope so.
Thank you for this pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hisham Matar's latest novel, award-winning novel, is Anatomy of a Disappearance, published in 2011. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Emily Woodbury. Caitlin Fry lent us some production assistance today. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music, written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on this program, how much do you know about how our Constitution shapes our lives? Well, we'll celebrate the Constitution's 225th anniversary with historian David Wendell. That's tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.